This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. West Indiana Legislative Delegation, as the 2019 General Assembly is wrapping up, and to find out how things have gone, in particular for our newest members, and we're talking with one of them now. We're talking with State Representative Carolyn Jackson. She represents the communities of Whiting and Hammond in District 1 of the House. And Carolyn, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you so much, Chris. I certainly appreciate this.
Well, let's get your assessment, since you are a new member. This is your first term and your first legislative session. What's your assessment of how things have gone for you, at least, as Representative District 1?
Well, let's start with this. It's a learning experience, but it was also a very good session, I think, coming as a new legislator.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I had some successes, and I also had some things that didn't happen that I really, really wanted to happen, things that would impact not only our region but the entire state of Indiana.
I know you put a number of measures up that have been in the hopper, and many of them I know have gone to committee and got referred there and probably didn't come out of committee, but they got introduced at least. Let's run down the list here of some of the interesting topics.
Okay.
A couple of them in particular, or a couple topics, we should say, in particular, you've introduced some measures on that were up for review this time. One type of topic was about firearms, the other about drinking water. Two very important topics for us here in Northwest Indiana. Let's start first, though, with the measure that you had with help from Representative Vernon Smith. You are the author of House Bill 1047, and it focuses on equal pay and wage disclosure protection. Tell us what that measure is all about.
Okay, basically what it was is here in the state of Indiana, we have a lot of instances where women do not make the same amount of money that their male counterpart does, who does the same work, same qualifications, side by side, everything is comparable. And as a result of that, my bill stated that they would not only be paid the same amount of money, but the employee would also have to be transparent. So they would have to let you know, be able to post it or share it or however they do it, so that everyone would know that that the male person is making X amount of dollars and the female is making X amount of dollars for doing the same position.
One of the other measures, and we talk about firearms in this case in particular here, is House Bill 1048. It's a bill that you introduced in this 2019 session, dealing with firearm storage. And then there is another bill as well that you've sponsored and got some help with representatives from not only from Northwest Indiana but elsewhere, about the surrender of firearms for domestic violence crimes. What prompted you, first off, to consider to put these two related bills in the hopper?
Okay, basically what prompted me was there are quite a few people in Northwest Indiana, unfortunately, who have had children to pass away as a result of a firearm that was not properly stored. The children were able to get their firearms and unfortunately kill a sibling. Another one was a situation where the child was being cared for at a daycare center or whatever, and the child got the gun and killed themselves.
I know the measure that you introduced here concerning domestic violence crimes and the like is one of note. That's gone into committee, at least, and unfortunately it seems as far as it got, as best as we can tell. But I'm sure you'll bring that one up again, too. Tell us your thoughts about being able to have the opportunity to make sure that persons that have firearms that may be involved in domestic crimes don't get those firearms back.
Exactly. My bill basically stated that if an individual who was found guilty of a domestic violence crime, they would not be able to maintain that gun, and within 72 hours they would have to surrender it.
One of the other measures that you brought up during this 2019 session, about drinking water in particular, is an interesting one, and it's about a problem we know that has happened, and maybe it's the situation involving the school city of Hammond that got you prompted to put this one in. House Bill 1433 is the measure that you got with co-sponsorship from Representative Vernon Smith of Gary about drinking water testing in schools and child care facilities. Tell us what the idea is behind that, and it doesn't seem that it made it into committee, but I'm sure it'll probably maybe come up again next session. Tell us about it, please.
Okay, basically what happened, as you know, the drinking water in School City of Hammond was tested, and they found high levels of lead to be in the water. And that sparked a lot of community involvement. It sparked a lot of community advocacy, people coming out complaining because they're concerned about the adverse effects that lead causes our children. So as a result of that, I was asked to present a bill regarding that because, as you know, children are our future, and we want them to be safe, and especially when there are irreversible damages that excess lead can cause when ingested by children. So I wanted that to protect not only those children in schools, but those children in daycare centers and child care centers as well, which is why I also had filed the bill regarding sex offenders living within a certain distance of child care centers. Apparently what has happened is that the current law as it is now, anybody who is a child sex offender can live within 1,000 feet of a child care center or a daycare center, and it's perfectly fine. But as you know, just like I do, many of those child care facilities not only care for infants and very small children, but they also care for children who have gotten out of school on spring break, on summer break as well. And fortunately, I was able to get that language put in Senate Bill 258, which was Frank Mervan's bill with regard to sex offender in residency. So that was one of my successes, which I'm very, very happy that we passed that last night in the House. So it looks like that one is something that will be on its way to the governor's desk. Mm-hmm.
One of the other measures I know that you co-sponsored, actually, or maybe you did sponsor, was a measure that went through Senate, too. It was you and Senator Lonnie Randolph worked together on this one. Involves protective orders and employment. That one did, I guess, get a hearing in committee. Tell us about that one.
Protective orders, yeah.
And employment. That's the way it's stated, at least. But it involves, I guess maybe asking for an interim study committee to take further look into the topic.
Yes. Right now, it looks like it's going to be fine. But again, you know, this is probably our last day. So you know how the last day goes.
Oh, yeah.
You never know.
Well, as we're speaking here on Wednesday, it's always a crazy time, to say the least, for legislators. And I know that one of the things I did want to ask you about, at least by this time, of course, that we have an opportunity to have it on Regionally Speaking is going to be past the session close, and we'll already, of course, know the final outcome. But what have been your thoughts concerning the process up to now about the two-year state budget that has gone through, and you get a chance to put your vote in on?
Okay, well, right now, we're in caucus discussing that, and I'm really not at liberty to really go into a lot of detail about it now. Because, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't know all the facts. And it's my understanding that the budget did not make it over to us until yesterday afternoon. And as a result of that, they're still looking at it. But the one thing that I did hear them mention was teacher pay.
Right.
So with the teacher's pay, it looks like there is going to be a small increase. I won't say it's an extremely large increase, but it looks like we can look to the teachers getting something. And I'm happy about it. And, of course, our teachers, we can never really thank them enough because it is a seriously hard job, and you really only get one opportunity to teach children, to make a big impact on them. And I think that our teachers are underpaid. And I would love to see them be rewarded with a higher salary. But right now, it looks like it's just going to be something that is going to be very minimal.
Looking ahead, and I'm going to finish up with the 2019 session, looking ahead to 2020, do you have any topics that you're thinking, maybe it's a little early to be sure to, you know, create actual bills, but some thoughts on maybe some topics and areas that you'd like to try to bring back as a legislator next session?
Yes, I am thinking that I will bring that equal pay back. Mm-hmm. Another one I don't know if you're familiar with, but that's the railroad crossing.
Oh, yes, you yes. Know, yeah, tell us about the measure. It was introduced, but it didn't make it very far this session, but doesn't mean it can't come back again. Tell us more about that.
That is correct. Basically, what that bill stated is if a train is knowingly going to sit on a track, block and cross more than 10 minutes, that they're required to notify the emergency responders.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, that would help with them being able to reroute in advance as opposed to going the shortest way, which is normal, and having to backtrack and go around and maneuver through the city. When it comes to emergency responders, as you know, every minute, every second counts. And with the way Hammond is laid out and Whiting is laid out, we don't want anyone to not receive the service that they need in cases of an emergency because our responders are rerouting constantly.
Well, just as you said at the outset of our conversation here, it's been a real learning experience, and I guess that you can at least take that away from your very first opportunity to serve at the State House for residents in Hammond and Whiting. And Carolyn, we thank you very much for spending time to review some of the measures you introduced, and no doubt we'll be able to bring back again next session when the next legislative session comes together. And we appreciate you talking about them today for us.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for having me, and as always, I will continue to look for the best for those in my community. Thank you.
You're welcome. We're talking with State Representative Carolyn Jackson. She's a Democrat, and she represents District 1 here in Northwest Indiana. Even though Indiana's air quality is improving, the American Lung Association says climate change is making it harder to protect people's health. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, that's the takeaway from the latest State of the Air report.
The report says the last 3 years were the hottest on record. That heat, combined with car emissions and other pollutants, increased ozone levels in many cities, including Indianapolis. Breathing in high levels of ozone can contribute to asthma or even shorten your life. 9 counties in Indiana received an F for ozone. Angela Tin is the National Senior Director of Clean Air Initiatives for the American Lung Association. She says the Trump administration's efforts to roll back air quality standards would hurt Indiana.
We need to consistently raise the standards so that there is a noticeable improvement in air quality.
To help improve the air, the American Lung Association suggests driving less, using less electricity, and urging Congress to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
The University of Notre Dame announced today that it was awarded a $2.4 million grant from the Lilly Endowment. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks tells us that they'll use the money to partner with businesses in northern Indiana that'll promote workforce and economic growth.
Notre Dame and the South Bend Elkhart Regional Partnership said they'll use the 5-year grant to form a coalition they're calling Labs for Industry, Futures, and Transformation, or LIFT. They plan to create a research lab at Notre Dame, enhance technical education programs at area schools, and provide grants to local nonprofits that provide training for emerging jobs. Notre Dame President Reverend John Jenkins said it's an opportunity to grow the region into the next Silicon Valley.
It's going to create new businesses and a new dynamism, and creativity spawns creativity. New businesses spawn other new businesses, so we hope there's a really wonderful virtuous cycle.
Regional partners hope to add an additional $127.6 million to the fund in matching contributions. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Several organizations and residents put the owners of a controversial large-scale organic dairy in Newton County on notice that they intend to sue in federal court to stop construction of the facility. Hoosier Environmental Council and Protect Our Kankakee River Basin have strongly opposed the dairy, which purchased the property near Lake Village in February of 2016. Kim Ferraro with the HEC tells us why they filed the 60-day notice of the lawsuit against Natural Prairie Dairy Farm in federal court in Hammond.
Under the Federal Clean Water Act, there is a provision, as with most federal environmental statutes, that allow for citizen suits to enforce the provisions of the Clean Water Act, and before you can bring one, you have to give the U.S. EPA and the state agency here, IDEM, some opportunity to address those violations and then the agency doesn't, then you can proceed. So that's what the notice is about.
Now, as a, I got a way of reminding us of what this is all about, tell us the problems that have developed over time there in Newton County with what the dairy farm wants to do and why what they want to do is not really good.
This is a very large concentrated animal feeding operation, or CAFO, with 4,350 dairy cattle that will produce the same amount of raw sewage as a town of roughly 300,000 people, so more than the whole population of Newton County. And they're proposing and have started construction of this CAFO right in where the in a very sensitive environmental area that was once a former lake bed of Beaver Lake, which folks probably in the area know was once the largest inland lake in Indiana before it was drained in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And what has been left behind in that sensitive area is a very shallow sand aquifer that is quite susceptible to contamination from the surface. So if pollutants are put on the ground, it very easily seeps into that groundwater, which people rely on for their drinking water. Wow. And also that area is being, has long been the subject and focus of restoration efforts by the Nature Conservancy, which has restored more than 7,000 acres of native prairie and wetlands, literally right next door to this CAFO site. There's the Willow Slough Wildlife, Nature Wildlife Area very close by. So all of these, environmentally sensitive areas are and groundwater are threatened by putting such a polluting, massive facility at this location. What the Clean Water Act citizen suit is about is because we have found out over the last almost 2 years of being involved in this case that Natural Prairie filled, without getting the required Clean Water Act permit, almost a half a mile of Bogus Island Ditch, which is a tributary of the Kankakee River. It was constructed to drain Beaver Lake long ago and provides drainage of the site. And to do that, before you fill ditches like that, you have to get permission from the federal government, and Natural Prairie didn't do that and is now going to be building this CAFO right on top of that filled ditch, preventing any sort of restoration of that illegal activity. The other thing that has happened is because of the nature of this site, because it was once a lake, it was once a wetland area, under the Clean Water Act recognizes these areas once they, if they were drained originally for farming purposes, for crop farming purposes, you can continue to raise crops in those sensitive areas. But if you change their use, as is happening here, to something else besides crop farming, then you have to get a permit from Army Corps of Engineers in order to fill those, in order to further impact that wetland area. And again, Natural Prairie didn't do that here.
It sounds very, very complicated, I guess, but it comes down to basics of whether we can maintain clean, uncontaminated drinking water, because so many people have wells in that area. And you're not only talking about humans, but you're also talking about animals, because there are farms that are out there anyway that will have to rely on the wells to be able to supply water for their animals. And we got that concern. And, of course, we always still have the Kankakee River not very far away, as well as the wildlife areas that are to the south of the proposed farm. So there are a lot of issues that they need to be taken up here, it seems.
That's exactly right. I don't know that I could add anything more to what you just said very well.
Now, how does this procedure, beyond the notice that we're going to file a lawsuit, work? What procedure do you have to go through now in federal court at this point?
Well, as I mentioned before, if IDEM or the federal US EPA steps in and begins an enforcement action against Natural Prairie, then we would be precluded from bringing a citizen suit. We would be able to intervene in any enforcement action brought by EPA or IDEM, but the citizen suit itself would not be allowed to proceed. If, on the other hand, US EPA and or IDEM decide not to proceed with an enforcement action, then we would file a lawsuit in the Northern District of Indiana, federal district court, mm-hmm. and we would litigate it as any other lawsuit.
Now, do you get the indication that IDEM, since they have already approved the permit for this work to begin, that they're liable to change their minds about this? Is that likely what they can do, or do they, many of these cases before, as you've seen elsewhere around the state, Kim, that they're not going to jump in and intervene?
You know, I hesitate to speculate what IDEM will or won't do. I will say we've been disappointed with the agency's response to this so far. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful that the agency will start to take this seriously, but as you point out, at this point, they haven't. I can tell you that in the past, agencies have brought limited enforcement actions that don't really address the problem as a way to preclude the citizen suit. So simply because the agency, either EPA or IDEM, brings an enforcement action doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to enforce in a way that would actually provide a remedy or provide protection. So we'll still be monitoring. I'm hopeful that the agencies will do the right thing and step up and enforce vigorously. But if they don't, we will intervene in any enforcement action that the agency brings to make sure that happens.
Well, Kim, thanks for the update. We appreciate it. And like everybody else, including the residents in the area around where the dairy farm is being proposed there in Newton County, we'll just have to wait and find out if IDEM or if the EPA decides to jump in and put a stop to all of this. And if not, that's going to turn into the lawsuit that we've already made notice about. It's going to happen, to be sure. Thanks for the update.
Thanks for your interest in the issue.
You're welcome. Kim Ferraro is with the Hoosier Environmental Council.
By the way, the Conservation Law Center at Indiana University's Bloomington campus is assisting the Hoosier Environmental Council and protect our Kankakee Valley Kankakee River Basin, with this particular matter. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Program consideration comes from Lithographic Communications. From 500 business cards or 500,000 direct mail pieces, Lithographic Communications, located in Munster, can handle it all. More information is available at 219-924-9779.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. The new book, Down from the Mountain, tells the story of a grizzly bear who became too accustomed to living near a Montana farm.
This cornfield was providing a perfect kind of a gateway drug to being comfortable around humans, which was eventually her unmaking.
The tragic collision between man and grizzly, next time on Here and Now. Tune in at 2 p.m. for Here and Now, here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
Work is underway again on the restoration of the pavilion at the Indiana Dunes State Park, and Dunes Action is once again protesting the project, and we have with us co-founder of Dunes Action, Jim Sweeney, to talk about it. Jim, thanks for joining us on the program today. We know that the work is continuing on restoration of the pavilion of the Indiana Dunes State Park, and Dunes Action is once again out in front protesting the project, and we have Jim Sweeney, the co-founder of Dunes Action, back on the line. Jim, we'll pick it up where we left off here, and having you explain the situation that has gotten the pavilion, which is a historic site, I guess, in a way, that's come before the public front here in the last couple of years.
Correct. The building was built in 1930. It's a great old Art Deco style. And a few years ago, the DNR put out a request for proposals to rehabilitate the building, to bring it back, to remodel it. It had been fallen into disrepair, hadn't been used in years. And we were very supportive of that. The public was very much supportive of rehabilitating the pavilion and using it again. What happened is what the proposal that the DNR accepted included not only rehabilitating the pavilion, but also building a brand new banquet center right next to it. So to be a brand new commercial banquet facility built on the beach right next door to the pavilion that would be used for weddings and things like that. And we just don't think that's the appropriate place for a commercial banquet facility. That part hasn't been addressed yet in the planning right now. Mm-hmm. The construction just started last week for the approved plant for the pavilion, and we have some problems with that. There's the planning. The primary point right now is the fact that Indiana state law requires that they obtain a certificate of approval from the DNR's Department of Historical Preservation, and that hasn't been obtained yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we notified the county prosecutor about that. I haven't heard back from him yet, but we're hoping to hear back from that soon.
When did you have the opportunity to bring this up before the Porter County Prosecutor's Office? Has that been within the last couple of weeks or longer?
Specifically regarding the certificate of approval, it's been one of our contentions for probably 2 years now that they have to get this certificate before they start construction, and they never did.
I know that Dunes Action has been at the forefront of protesting the plans to restore the pavilion because of the way that the Pavilion Partners LLC wants to do it, and then, of course, adding on the extra space to there, too. Which other groups are joining you in this effort to again, bring it ever to the public and let people know that they're not doing it the way that they really should?
The original organizations that supported our effort to defeat the banquet hall included the Hoosier Environmental Council, the Sierra Club, the Citizens Action Coalition out of Indianapolis.
What kind of options do you have if the DNR is going ahead and would say they've even issued this approval to go ahead with the project? What options do you have right now, seeing as that you've already kind of brought this up and it's had a fight that's going on for at least a year now?
The controversy actually has been going on for 4 years now. It started in 2015 when they signed a lease with Brilliant Partners. So options that we have, we could potentially sue over the lack of the certificate of approval, but that's probably not the best use of anybody's time and resources.
Mm-hmm.
It's because the powers that be could just say, you can go get the certificate of approval, and in a couple months they'd be good to go. That's one of the options that's possible. What we've been doing is applying as much pressure as we can just by talking to the local public, the people that care about the state park, and getting them to write letters, make phone calls. We haven't been able to coach the DNR to having a public meeting on this project yet, so we're still trying to do that as well.
You were trying last year, as I recall, trying to get public meetings from the DNR set up to be able to let citizens talk about this, and it was no luck back then. And you're assuming that you're not going to have the same luck this year?
Well, there's different parts of the planning process that actually require a public hearing. And I think the certificate of approval is one of them. Another one is the formal conversion process that would be required of the DNR by the National Park Service, because all the parties have agreed that if they move ahead with the banquet facility on the beach, that they are actually removing public land from public outdoor recreation, and they need to replace that. And part of that replacement process includes public hearings. So we've been trying to get the DNR to hold a public hearing for a couple of years now, and they have not acquiesced.
What kind of response have you gotten here lately from residents in Porter County complaining about what has happened, certainly last year at the pavilion at the Indiana Dunes State Park, and what that is planned for this year as the construction work, the restoration work, as it will, continues?
Well, there's a lot of people that are just very much upset. First off, because the construction has started, secondarily, because not according to our reading of the law, they're not compliant with all the requirements yet. There are some people that have been taking photographs and watching the construction activities that have started. They've been worried about safety violations that they've seen. They've been worried about some possible damage to some of the structure, the architectural structures of the pavilion building. So, the safety things is really not our primary concern, but we have been forwarding those concerns on to the proper authorities.
Now, if anybody is concerned and they have maybe just learning about all this, where can they find out more, and where can they be able to get involved?
Well, we have a what we call our public page on Facebook. You can look that up, look up Dunes Action. As much possible, because the social media is so big these days, that's probably the most expedient thing to do, is find out what's going on with the Dunes Action and the pavilion, is through our Facebook page. We also have a website. You can look up dunesaction.org. There's information available there. I try to be as available for people in the public as I can to answer questions and such.
Well, Jim, thank you for spending time with us to give us the latest here involving the action where the restoration work is once again resumed at the pavilion at the Indiana Dunes State Park, and the fact that Dunes Action and other organizations are very concerned about how the project is handling. And we will keep an eye on it and be back with you if we ask for some updates, too. I hope you'll help us. Thank you very much.
Good. Thanks, Chris.
Jim Sweeney is the co-founder of Dunes Action. He and other members of Dunes Action and other organizations in Northwest Indiana are very concerned about how the pavilion is being renovated at the Indiana Dunes State Park. Franciscan Health Michigan City now has a Safe Haven Baby Box. That means that new mothers who wish to give up their newborn can do so legally and in a way that is safe for the baby and anonymously without fear of arrest or prosecution as a last resort for women in crisis. Monica Kelsey is the founder and CEO of Safe Haven Baby Boxes, and she told Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson that she created the organization out of her own experience and says bringing the baby box to the Franciscan Health in Michigan City was a long time coming.
We've been actually working with Franciscan Health for the last 3 years. Once we put a box in Cold Springs, Franciscan is all about, they value life. They wanted to be a part of this. So we've been working with them for 3 years. We knew that they had to build their hospital first. So this is a great opportunity for us to partner with them to not only bring more baby boxes to the state of Indiana, but to also value life with their help. So we're super excited about this.
So I was going to ask why it took 3 years. Is it because they had to build the hospital first?
Yeah, they had the other hospital, and then they knew that they were moving out of that hospital. We didn't want to install in that old hospital, so we just waited for them to do the new hospital. And in the meantime, while they were building that hospital, we've had two babies in Cold Springs Fire Department right there in Michigan City. Plus, we had a handoff safe surrender back in April of last year, so three babies have come from LaPorte County just since we installed the baby boxes at Cold Spring. So we knew that we needed another box in that area.
I was reading your story about you and how you came to create this. Can you go ahead and share that with us?
Absolutely. Back in 1972, when abortion was illegal in our country, a 17-year-old girl was brutally attacked. She was raped. She was left along the side of the road. She pressed charges against the man who had raped her, and he was arrested and charged. And if that wasn't the worst of it, she finds out she's pregnant 6 weeks later. And at the advice of her mother, she found herself at a back alley abortion facility in October of 1972. And while standing in front of the man that was going to take her child's life, this 17-year-old girl changed her mind. And she was hidden for the remainder of the pregnancy. She gave birth in April of 73 and abandoned her child 2 hours after that child was born. And that child was me. So I am, by all accounts, an unwanted child being conceived in rape and abandoned at birth. But every child is wanted by someone. And I want these women to know that there are options for these children. And there's no shame, there's no blame when you choose the safe haven law. These children's lives can go on, and so can the mother's life go on with no shame. So I started Safe Haven Baby Boxes because of my own story. And I believe that such a time as this, these boxes are needed, especially with everything that's happening across this country with the abortion laws.
How did your life turn out? How do you feel about what had happened, how you were brought into the world?
It definitely was a shock when I found out. I was 37 years old. I was an adult. So it was a blessing that I was older when I actually got to meet my biological mother and view the reports and stuff. But I really kind of had to dig a little bit deeper than normal, because I had to find myself and find my worth. And unfortunately, people in society today make us feel, or make me feel sometimes, that I'm unworthy of even life. And what happened back in 1972 was not my fault. It had nothing to do with me. I was a victim of that crime as well. And the fact that my birth mother was strong enough to carry me to term, I think speaks volumes about the love that these mothers have for their children. And getting to meet me 37 years later, she never had any more children after me, which is very common with rape victims. And being able to reconnect with me 37 years later, she got to see that the daughter that she saved is now saving others.
How is your relationship with your birth mother? Do you both have an ongoing relationship?
I got to spend about 3 years with her before she passed away. And the relationship that we had was amazing. She wondered about me her entire life growing up, and every birthday she actually baked me a cake, and that was how she honored me. And it was just such a blessing to get to know her and to get to know her heart, and I think that was what gave me empathy that I needed to be able to work with women today who don't choose good options, and push me a little bit harder to make sure that these women know of all the positive options that are out there.
So is Safe Haven, does it have anything to do with abortion laws and trying to encourage women not to have abortions? Or is it just simply the focus of just giving women an out?
We don't classify ourselves as pro-life or pro-choice simply because we want to help any woman that comes to us. And the women that come to us are in their final days of pregnancy, or they have just given birth to a baby and they're sitting on their bathroom floor and they're in crisis mode. Those are the women who are calling our hotlines wanting to know what they can do legally to make sure that they don't get in trouble criminally and that their child's life can go on. So we don't look at this as an abortion debate at all. This is a child who has been born, that is living, breathing, that just deserves his right to life just like anyone else does. We're simply trying to give these mothers another option. We want to be able to help these moms, and if it's a parenting plan that we help her with, or an adoption plan that we help her with, or a safe surrender that we help her with, we want to do what's best for her, let her make that decision what's best for her, and then make sure that she follows the law according to that so that she doesn't end up in prison. And we don't want women to find themselves in this situation. There are better options than this. And those children deserve to be placed in a safe place where fire and medical can arrive quickly, assess the child, and take the child to the hospital.
And I understand that getting the word out about Safe Haven is one of your big goals. And another one of your big goals is to get Safe Haven baby boxes in all 50 states.
The goal, of course, is in all 50 states within 2025. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize is baby boxes is a visual. Right now, you have no visual. If I ask somebody about the Safe Haven law, they can't say, oh, isn't it that box at the fire station that's on the side of the building? They can't say that unless there's a box at the side of a fire station in their town. But those boxes that are in these fire stations and in these hospitals is a constant reminder that the Safe Haven law is alive and well. Our goal is to never have a woman choose one of our baby boxes. And that's crazy, I know, to say when we're pushing these so hard, but the better option is a parenting plan or an adoption plan or walking into a facility and handing a child over. February 22nd of this past year, we had a woman walk to a fire station that was going to place her child in one of our boxes. This fire station had a Safe Haven baby box, and she decided with the help of us to hand that child to a person. That is what we recommend. But having these boxes in the side of fire stations and hospitals is a constant reminder of the Safe Haven law. Whereas right now, if I don't tell you about it, you're not going to know about it, because people just don't Google Safe Haven law 1999 when the law was enacted. they find themselves in a crisis and they freak out. And hopefully, with us putting boxes in these fire stations, they can say, you know what? I remember a box in the fire station off 108th Street in Carmel, Indiana. I can take my child there, no questions asked, and turn around and walk away, and it's completely legal. Our goal for the education and awareness, and then, of course, getting into the schools and educating these girls and boys on safe surrenders and what a good option is.
That's Monica Kelsey, who is the founder and CEO of Safe Haven Baby Boxes, speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. Time once again for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Tim King, who is the interim executive director over at the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra. And Tim, it's nice to have you here.
Thank
for one
you.
Thing. And
thank
I,
you.
And also, we're laughing that this is not your first rodeo the interim executive director.
Exactly. I moved to the area in 2013, and previously I was in Louisville for many, many years, mm-hmm. and was involved with the Louisville Orchestra for several of those years. Mm-hmm. Came up here expecting to just retire and have a really good time. And this is the second time I've been pressed into service to serve the LaPorte County Symphony. New York's, but it's fine. As you know, John, it's a passion, and so I don't mind it at all.
That's good. Well, it's very good of you to step forward.
Thank you.
And take the lead. and especially when, well, we'll get to your, you have a concert coming up this coming weekend.
Right.
But you're also in the process, the orchestra is in the process of finding a new music director.
That is correct.
So,
that is correct.
Well, let's talk first about the concert this weekend.
Okay.
It's a tribute to Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Right. It's a Saturday, May the 4th at mm-hmm. the Civic Auditorium. In LaPorte, and people can find all the information about that at lcso.net, mm-hmm. our website, and they can also buy tickets over the website. Unfortunately, all of our table seats are gone, so that's a good problem to have, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but we still have seats left in the balcony. And it's going to feature our third music director candidate this year, and that's Alexander Platt. Mm-hmm. Alexander lives in Chicago, and he already is the music director of a couple of orchestras in Wisconsin, smaller budget orchestras in Wisconsin. And so he devised this Rodgers and Hammerstein program, which I think he's done before, mm-hmm. and we're doing a lot of these Robert Russell Bennett arrangements, which are wonderful arrangements with Rodgers and Hammerstein. As you can imagine, Carousel, South Pacific, Cinderella, mm-hmm. Sound of Music, it just goes on and on. And we've also formed a community chorus as well, the first time, and we had our first rehearsal last night, and it went extremely well. I was so pleased, because you know, sometimes when you have chorus and you have the first rehearsal and nobody knows each other, the first 10 or 15 minutes can sort of be a train wreck.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the case. Our interim music director, Chuck Steck, who is also our principal trumpeter, formed the chorus and uh-huh. is directing the chorus, and so that's going to be their debut on this concert as well.
How many people do
there's going
have?
To be close to 75 people.
Wow.
Yeah, we're very, very pleased with the turnout that's happened
excellent.
With that.
Well, yeah, you've got to have these songs have to be sung.
That's right.
For sure. We did as you know, I'm associated with Northwest Indiana
right.
Symphony, and
right.
we did a Rodgers and Hammerstein concert a few years ago, and it was very, very successful. People respond.
They do, don't they? They do. And we're also working out a couple of audience participation pieces, Edelweiss and mm-hmm. Climb Every Mountain. We'll see how the audience does
cool.
on Climb Every Mountain. Maybe all of them should probably not take the high note, but we'll see.
Well, I like I like your setup in LaPorte with being able to get some nibbles and slurps, as I call it, and take
yeah.
them into the auditorium.
That's correct.
The people who – you call the bleachers, you call that the balcony?
We call that the balcony,
so the balcony people can also have
yes, they can.
Refreshments.
That's correct.
That's nice.
That's
yes,
correct.
I think that's a nice touch. I think
thank
it adds
you.
To the social aspect. Of
well,
the
that's
evening.
Why our table seats do so well.
Yeah.
You know, people love the fact of before the concert and during intermission, they can really socialize with their friends. And so we have a lot of companies and corporations that buy the tables of eight and families that buy the tables of eight. And that's why it's – and combine that with Rodgers and Hammerstein, and it was a pretty easy sell.
Right. So the music director search has been going on this season.
That's correct. We started it in November, and we're going to do it over the period of 2 years
mm-hmm.
because being a smaller budget orchestra that we are, we only have three subscription. We actually do seven concerts a year, but only three of them are subscription concerts.
I see.
And so we felt like we needed to see more than three people.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be seeing six people. So the 19-20 season is we have these three, and then we're going to continue that into the 18-19 this year and then the 19-20 season next year. So after we have the six people, which I'm happy to say that two of them are women. Oh, you know, as you know, in the orchestra world, for some reason, there's not that many women conductors.
That's true. That's
and so
true.
These two rose right to the top, and we've already had one, and one will be in next November. And again, all that information is on our website, too. All the information about these music director candidates is on lcso.net. So we'll continue that process through the, through May of 2020, and we have a search committee that will make that decision and bring their recommendations to the board. But the neat thing about this is that anyone who comes to a concert gets to critique the conductor. So not only the musicians and the committee and the board, but the our audience and subscribers and single ticket buyers even get to give their two cents about the conductor.
It's like Yelp. It's very democratic.
It's right. It's a lot of work, as you can imagine, trying to collate all that stuff.
Well, Tim, we'll have to have you back to give us an update on,
well, thank
on
you.
The search and,
I appreciate
and next
that.
Season as well. But in the meantime, thank you for being here.
It was my pleasure.
Today, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear this conversation again on Eye on the Arts on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And join us again next Monday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio for another Eye on the Arts conversation. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.